from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, 450 economists, 10 Nobel laureates, and one full-page statement yesterday in the New York Times in sharp rebuke of the Bush tax cut plan, which is not credible, these economists say, as an economic stimulus package for the country. Worse, they say it is destructive. We're joined tonight by two Nobel laureates who have lined up in opposition to President Bush's economic vision, and one who stands firmly by the president's side. Tonight, On Point, a clash of Nobel titans over the Bush tax cuts. We began on Capitol Hill, where today the president took another blow to his tax cut plan from Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan. For the second day, the Fed chair warned against tax cuts producing federal deficits. Jonathan Wiseman is economic policy correspondent for The Washington Post. I asked him to describe Mr. Greenspan's message.
Mr. Greenspan said several things, so of course it depends on what you choose to amplify. He did endorse, as expected, the president's call to end the so-called double taxation of dividends, but he did so in the context of a long-term tax reform and said that we really, A, need to be concerned about the budget deficit, and if we're going to be making tax cuts, we should be doing so through pay-as-you-go rules, meaning that you would want to raise other taxes or cut spending to go along with those tax cuts. And I think most importantly, and the thing that the White House is most focused on, he said that we actually should not be doing anything right now to stimulate the economy, because when you look kind of at the economy through the fog of a build-up to war, we don't know what the economy is doing. We don't know whether the economy will lift up by itself very quickly and very efficiently after a war with Iraq. So why do something now?
Jonathan Wiseman, so many questions raised here. First of all, is the Bush administration even describing this as a stimulus plan anymore? That phrase has been attached to it, but now we have Jon Snow describing it as tax reform, not stimulus. So is this a plan to pull the economy now out of the doldrums, or is it long-term tax reform?
Well, it is long-term tax reform, and they've always wanted it to be long-term tax reform, but they had been selling it as short-term stimulus. They called it an economic growth package. They always did want to avoid the stimulus term. In the wake of the Greenspan testimony, the emphasis has definitely come on to the long term. Now, Snow also did say that they would have more bang for the buck in the short term than it is getting credit for. But he said that he would not support any package just to boost the economy. It had to be good economic policy, good tax reform.
The other big policy element that Greenspan raised, deficits, and a very strong position against them. This also in the teeth of a White House that has been prepared to run with deficits.
That's right. This White House has been saying repeatedly two things, that the deficit that we are seeing is small, is manageable relative to the size of the economy, and would not have any negative economic consequences. That is, it wouldn't raise interest rates, especially long-term interest rates.
And Greenspan's view of deficits?
And Greenspan said, and this was probably the most pointed slap at the White House, when he said, contrary to what some people are saying, deficits do matter. Deficits do raise up interest rates and do affect the economy. And nobody in this room failed to see that he was referring to were in the administration.
So how does this testimony, 2 days on Capitol Hill by Alan Greenspan, play out for the Bush tax cut proposals?
That is really to be seen. I've always felt like the administration and Congress seem to forget what Washington is like in a war. If we actually attack Iraq in a few weeks' time, this city will be consumed with war fever. Nothing else will be on anybody's radar screen. And when the dust settles, we could be in a completely different world. To say that Greenspan's testimony is definitive is to ignore the fact that something much more important is about to happen in this city.
Was White House spokesman Ari Fleischer in effect acknowledging that when he said that the administration doesn't expect Congress to focus on the details of a tax package until late April at the earliest?
He was actually looking at the schedule that Congress has put out for putting together a budget for the coming fiscal year, 2004, and going through the whole process of passing that budget. Now, the Republicans in the past, especially the Republicans in the House, have kind of gone around all of those niceties and done what the president has wanted very quickly in the past. So he is acknowledging that they aren't going to get the slam dunk that they might have wanted. But I don't think that was really an acknowledgement of the impact the war is going to have. And what's remarkable is that there's a sense of unreality in Washington, both on Capitol Hill and the White House, that the foreign policy realm is operating on parallel but extremely separate tracks from their domestic policy realm, even though in reality these things are intricately entwined. And there is really no way we're going to get any kind of major tax cut until we find out what a war produces.
I guess I have to ask then, Jonathan Weissman, what's the talk about potential effects of the war? What's the great change?
Well,
it's still the American economy on the other side of a war, isn't it?
Well, what Greenspan is saying is the biggest thing that is holding back this economy is investors and business leaders holding back major decisions on investments, on hiring, on expansions, because they worry that the war will go badly, that it will actually cause a recession by raising new terrorism fears and certainly raising oil prices. And until those worries are allayed, no amount of stimulus, no amount of tax policies is going to change people's behavior.
And Greenspan made that pretty clear, but didn't he leave a kind of barricade across the road that will last when he said, you should not cut these taxes without raising other taxes to offset the revenue loss, something the Bush administration clearly does not intend to do. Isn't that a long-term problem? Isn't that a leave behind from the Fed chairman today?
I think that is a long-term problem for the Bush administration, but look, this Congress has not been particularly mindful of deficit warnings in the past. The last time Greenspan went up on Capitol Hill, he also issued that deficit warning. But the thing that most of the lawmakers took away was that he said that he thought it was a good idea to make the tax cuts permanent. It all depends on what you want to focus on. In fact, right now, Republican congressional leaders are emailing to lobbyists copies of Greenspan's testimony, you know, highlighting his support for the double taxation of dividends. And in fact, I was just on the phone with a Republican lobbyist who says that he thought that Greenspan's testimony was a net positive for the president because it gave everybody talking points about how wonderful the elimination of the double taxation on dividends is.
People hearing what they want to hear. Jonathan Weissman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Jonathan Weissman is economic policy correspondent for the Washington Post. He spoke with us earlier from Washington. Yesterday, in a full-page ad in the New York Times, 450 American economists, including 10 Nobel Prize winners, signed a statement sharply protesting the Bush tax cut plan. They accused the administration of pushing radical tax cuts that will drive up deficits, diminish government's capacity for good, and widen the chasm of American inequality. And by the way, they say, the tax cuts also won't stimulate the economy. But others are saying, no, tax cuts are the best way to rein in big government, keep federal spending in check, and fuel long-term growth. Tonight on Point, a clash of titans. We're joined by two Nobel laureates who have lined up in opposition to the Bush administration's tax cut plan, and one Nobel laureate who's standing firmly in the president's corner. Where do you stand? Are the Bush tax cuts a weapon of mass destruction aimed at the middle class, or are they foundation stones of a new era of small government and big economic growth? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Longboat Key, Florida, is Paul Samuelson, Emeritus Professor of Economics at MIT and 1970 Nobel Prize winner. He's visiting professor of economics at New York University. Good evening and welcome, Paul Samuelson.
Nice to be in this conversation.
It's very good to have you. Thanks so much for joining us. Also joining us tonight from Berkeley, California, Daniel McFadden, Professor of Economics at the University of California, Berkeley, and a winner of the Nobel Prize for Economics in the year 2000. Good evening and welcome, Daniel McFadden.
Thank you, and good evening.
Thanks so much for being with us, to you as well. Paul Samuelson, Daniel McFadden, you both signed the statement in opposition to President Bush's tax cuts. We will hear momentarily from Milton Friedman, another Nobel Prize-winning economist, who is strongly in support of the president's policy. But I wonder, Paul Samuelson, if you first might take us down through your checklist of concerns with the Bush tax cut plan that led you to come out so publicly in opposition.
Yes. First, America has a basic long-term macroeconomic problem. Everybody knows it. Our birth rate has been steadily falling. Our death rates have been steadily falling. By the year 2020, we go through a veritable population revolution. We're not alone in this. Japan is further down that trail. Italy is further down that trail. All advanced economies are in that problem. The Bush tax agenda not only ignores this problem, but it would aggravate and exacerbate this problem. What does basic economics, the kind of economics I was taught at the University of Chicago, say should be done for a society which faces the problem that I've described? What it says is that we should, in this period leading up to the retirement of the baby boomers, my six children who will be retiring in 20 years, at a time when the labor force relative to the retirees, and these retirees are going to live long lifetimes like myself, like Milton Friedman, like Dan McFadden will live, we should be a very high saving nation. We should be a high inducer of capital formation, factories, equipment. We should be planting trees, the nuts of which can help us live off in this period when the revolution hits us.
And you're describing now a population revolution, Paul Samuelson, with a graying workforce where fewer younger American workers are supporting many retirees. Why doesn't the Bush tax cut plan put us in a position to deal well with that in your mind?
See where we appeared to be in 1999, 1988, in the last years of the Clinton terms when a populist president got converted into basic economics, and we were exactly on the track to do what a majority of the macroeconomists who have studied this problem have said should be done. Now, in contrast, we've gone back to what George Bush Sr. once, in a moment that he regrets, I'm sure, called voodoo economics. Namely, reduce any tax, any time, do anything that will put pressure on government to cut spending, and hope that this will so increase innovation, incentives, total factor productivity, that you won't be harmed by it. I'm reminded of the time when Neanderthal Keynesians pooh-poohed every argument against the deficit. It's strange new bedfellows are using those arguments.
Daniel McFadden, if I may turn to you for a moment, you've called this tax cut plan a weapon of mass destruction aimed at the middle class. Those are your words we've been quoting. Why?
The reason that I take this view is that the tax cut will itself have to be paired either with government deficits into the distant future or some substantial cuts in government spending. The cuts in government spending are most likely to be in programs which the middle class benefit from, such as spending on education, Social Security, and Medicare. So my view is that this particular tax cut proposal is quite strongly non-neutral. That is, it will primarily benefit the wealthy who do not hold their savings primarily in income and the tax sheltered accounts.
And in a word, we've got a break coming up. Might it not produce economic growth that would float all boats up anyway?
It might. That is to say, ending double taxation of dividends, I think there is an argument for that, a reasonable economic for that, and it would be helpful. I think that in its particulars, this is not the way to go about eliminating the double taxation of dividends.
General McFadden, Paul Samuelson, please stand by. We've got a short break coming up. I'm sorry about that. We've got a Nobel challenge here tonight to the Bush tax plan and a Nobel defense coming up, a clash of titans here. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Nobel Challenge to the Bush tax plan and a Nobel defense. You can join the conversation tonight. Can 450 economists, 10 of them Nobel laureates, all be wrong? What is President Bush gunning for that these economists are not? And is President Bush's tax cut plan, in Daniel McFadden's words, a weapon of mass destruction aimed at the middle class, or is it the key to long-term economic growth? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are fortunate tonight to be joined by three Nobel Prize winners in economics. We've been speaking with Paul Samuelson, Emeritus Professor of Economics at MIT and a visiting Professor of Economics at New York University, 1970 Nobel Prize winner, and Daniel McFadden, Professor of Economics at the University of California, Berkeley, winner of the Nobel Prize in the year 2000. We are joined now from San Francisco by Milton Friedman, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution and 1976 Nobel Prize winner in economics. Good evening and welcome, Milton Friedman.
Glad to be with you.
Thank you very much for joining us. Milton Friedman, I'm sure you've seen the statement that was published in the New York Times yesterday and signed by this significant number of economists. I want to get your response to the points they've made. They say that the purpose of this of the Bush tax cut plan is a permanent change in the tax structure, not the creation of jobs and growth in the near term. They say the dividend tax cut is misdirected, that these tax cuts will worsen the long-term budget outlook, will add to the nation's projected chronic deficits, will reduce the capacity of the government to finance Social Security and Medicare, as well as investments in schools, health, infrastructure, and basic research. Moreover, they say the proposed tax cuts will generate further inequalities in after-tax income. So, Milton Friedman, what's your defense?
My defense is that what really matters and what I'm really concerned about
is
government spending. Government today is spending close to half, is spending or leading us to spend close to half of our total income. And we are not getting our money's worth. Paul Samuelson's point about the demographic problem arising down the pike.
2020.
It's very well taken. He's absolutely right. That is a serious problem.
Mm-hmm.
The way to get ready for that is to hold down government spending so there's leeway in the budget, so that there's more of the national income available for the people who retire. My view is very different from that which is expressed by the others for
mm-hmm.
one simple reason.
Mm-hmm.
They take it for granted that government spending is predetermined, that government spending is what it's going to be, and the question is, how do you finance it? I do not believe that is the case. I think government spending is determined very differently. I think that the government will spend whatever the tax system will raise, plus as much more as they can get away with. And that if you simply raise taxes, you are not, in fact, going to prevent deficits. That will simply lead government to spend more and produce more deficits. And that seems to be carried out by the course of history. Since you got some surpluses at the end of the 90s for a very simple reason. It was because the presidency was in the Democrats' hand and the Congress was in the hand of the Republicans. So you had gridlock, and it was hard to get spending through. Now, if that situation changes as it has changed, the main effect of not cutting taxes will not be a bigger deficit. It will be more government spending.
Milton Friedman, if I understand your argument then, you actually welcome deficits sort of the way we welcome a firebreak around a forest fire. Deficits aren't great, but they contain a worse evil in your mind, which is large government spending.
Well, the question is how the deficit comes about. If the deficit comes about because of increasing spending, it's a very bad thing. Because of the increase in spending. But if it comes about via a reduction in taxes, it is a firebreaker, exactly what you say. It's a force that presses Congress to spend less.
But what about the investment that the signatories to the statement in the Times yesterday describe as their fear for the capacity of the government to finance fundamental programs like Social Security, and we might include Medicare,
and their
interest in government investment in schools, health, infrastructure, basic research?
And what about all the government spending that is wasteful? What about the enormous agricultural bill that was passed, farm bill that was passed recently? The fact of the matter is that there is a certain amount of government spending that's absolutely necessary. But given the present size of the government, much of it is doing harm, not good.
Milton Friedman, please stand by. I want to get Paul Samuelson's response. Paul Samuelson, how about it? Milton Friedman describes deficits, large deficits, as a kind of cod liver oil, but worth it if it leads to reduced government spending, which he sees as an absolute good.
Well, yes, this is a complete rerun of the 1981 debate under the new Reagan administration. The new right conservative wanted to starve the government. If you have a tapeworm in a human being, you starve the human being in the hope that the tapeworm will die. Mm. Let's consider what can be, with great plausibility, predicted down the road if these massive long-run tax cuts,
yes,
geared mostly towards people like me, who've been very lucky in life and are very affluent, mm-hmm, you are going to come to a time just like what's happened to the workers at Bethlehem Steel. They've just been taken over by a different company.
Right.
The company can say, truthfully, we don't have the money to honor those contracts which you made with you before you retired, and we're stopping your retirement checks. We're going to stop the checks down the road on Social Security, not because we're cruel, but because, well, it just isn't the money. This inevitably follows. When you've willed the means, you will reap the ends.
The Bush administration, though, seems to take Milton Friedman's view. They seem to be actively embracing this path, even if it has that kind of sharp edge of the sword impact.
I want to ask Paul.
Yes.
Milton Friedman.
If he gets this big tax cut, is he going to eat more? Is he going to wear more clothes?
I sure am.
You are not. You are not. You know darn well you're not, Paul.
I'm sorry,
what
Milton.
What you're going to do with them?
I'm sorry. I'm a very rational man, and I know what, under the previous tax situation, is going to be my income to the end of my actuarial life, and I've taken that into account, and boy, are we making plans under the new regimen. Now, it's because I disapprove of that I signed the bill, not because my interest. And in fact, the steam behind this very fundamentally long-run reform, which is going to be destructive, mm-hmm, of the whole tax base, has two win-holy alliances.
Which reform are you talking about?
I'm talking about the stated agenda of Mr. Cheney and the president. Now, there are two.
You mean the double taxation of dividends?
No, that's only one feature of it.
That's a major feature.
No, the estate tax, which I have been facing up to ahead, mm-hmm, is to be gone.
That would be a good thing too.
Milton Friedman, I'm going to turn to you. Milton Friedman, I'm going to turn to you momentarily. I just want to get Paul Samuelson's. You were headed, Paul, toward your interpretation of intent here.
Yeah. What I wanted to say, where the steam comes for it. There are two groups, each of which can be respected because they have a viewpoint, and we're in a democracy. There's a libertarian group which believes that most of government is bad in and of itself, and anything that can bring it down, even if it causes the pathologies of deficit to do it, is a good thing. But the other, and I think much more fundamental one, is the pocketbook people who just want, being affluent, to be more affluent. And you can see that because whenever the government can be used to increase their affluence, they do not take the libertarian view. They pursue every loophole in the bill and use every part of the small print of the of the legislation.
Milton Friedman, let me turn to you. Are you suggesting, on the contrary, that these tax cuts will lead to capital formation, greater investment, and therefore economic growth?
Let me say that I'm in the libertarian group that Paul spoke of, but let me go to that point. Yes, I am. Indeed, it will. The fact of the matter is that these people Paul is talking about who want nothing but the bottom line now pay the great majority of all taxes in the country. And they are not going to consume much more. They have all they want from that point of view. The tax reductions will end up with a larger amount of saving, a larger amount of investment.
Daniel McFadden, jump in here if you would. We know which side you come down on, but referee this for us a little bit. We need a third Nobel Prize winner to referee these two.
We need a fourth one.
We need a fourth. We do indeed. But give us your interpretation of what we're hearing, Daniel McFadden.
Let me say, first of all, that I'm glad to hear Milton front what I think is the real agenda here, which is shrinking government. And I think that is something that should be part of the public debate,
but hasn't been put forward in an entirely forthright fashion. This was really presented as a stimulus plan. Now people are backing off that.
Well, I think that there is a problem with it tackling that fundamental issue of what this society wants in terms of its size of its government and what's provided by the government, what's provided by the private sector, through considering tax policy alone without the other side, without deciding what programs the government should or should not be doing. I would welcome a reasoned debate of what is desirable and what is not desirable for the government to do. But Milton raised the question, for example, of the agricultural farm bill and how wasteful that is.
Subsidies for agriculture.
I would say that if that's viewed as an inefficient program, and I think Milton so views it, then he should be urging this administration to tackle that straight on. There's more than one way to shrink government. You can shrink government by getting rid of the inefficient programs rather than using a blanket hammer of tax cuts, which just create a deficit situation which has to be resolved in some perhaps inappropriate way.
Milton Friedman, I wonder if you agree with that. My sense reading your work is that you don't think there's a way to reduce government spending surgically very effectively, that you welcome a blanket hammer.
Unfortunately, there is not. We've got lots of experience. We've had lots of inefficient programs. The agricultural program, we all know it's a bad program. There is, I suspect that every one of the economists who signed that ad would agree that the agricultural program is an inefficient and wasteful program. But that doesn't get rid of it. And it's the same way. The only way in which people are constrained from overspending is by limits, by income limits. If your child is spending wastefully, what you do is cut his allowance. The same thing goes for the government.
Milton Friedman, Paul Samuelson, Daniel McFadden, three Nobel Prize winners. We have a lot of regular citizens who would like to join this conversation and get your views. If I may, I'd like to turn to them. Sean's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Sean. You're on the air.
Hello. How's it going?
Fine, thanks.
Great. All right. I'm going to try and ask a simple question that I've been wondering about for a while, and I'm trying to remain unbiased on this new tax bill that's being proposed.
All right.
And it is, historically, it is to any of your guests today, or even you, historically, has there been any evidence to indicate that tax cuts of any kind, whether it's on dividends or it's on income, and even, you know, the extent of the cut, that it does indeed affect any sort of economic indicators in a positive way.
So you'd like to hear historical evidence that tax cuts improved the economy. Daniel McFadden, let me turn that first to you, if I may.
Actually, I was hoping you would ask one of the others, but the tax cuts in the 1960s that were primarily on the business side, I think are widely viewed as having been successful in providing stimulus.
Milton Friedman?
Investment tax credit. May I?
Paul Samuelson, please.
May I speak to the experience?
Yes, please.
After 1981, when exactly these arguments were used, and actually I think Milton, you and I, on one occasion or another, were in public debates with each other. The supply-siders said that if you actually cut tax rates, you will be on the better side of the Laffer curve, and you will be splashed with revenue.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I didn't believe that. I don't believe that Milton believed that. But what about the argument that you create the deficit, and that will cut down on the wasteful government expenditure? If you follow what happened, there was not an outburst of new incentives as a result of the deficits created by giving the people back, quote, their own money. Total factor productivity did not show a rise that the supply-siders had predicted. What did happen was precisely what I am predicting will happen, and I believe this is even consistent with the permanent income hypothesis that some very great scholar got a Nobel Prize for, that the saving rate dropped, the consuming rate rose, and this situation, which carried out through the 1980s, comes as near to a positivist controlled experiment. There are no controlled experiments like those in physics and economics. Mm-hmm. We deal with human beings.
Yes.
We're not molecules. But the econometric evidence, which has been summarized by in lots of National Bureau of Economic Research papers, did not show any of the forecasts made about the enlivening of Schumpeterian productivity in that particular period.
Let me turn that to Milton Friedman.
Yes,
Milton Friedman, Sean in Milwaukee asks, do tax cuts create economic growth? And I guess the 1980s are the parallel that everyone's focused on.
In the 1980s, my interpretation of the 1980s is very different than Paul's. In the first place, the deficits that arose in the 1980s was not because of the tax cuts. It was because of a successful reduction of inflation, which brought down the receipts from the taxes that had been in effect before. And it was also from the expansion of the military expenditures directed at the Cold War. The fact of the matter is that there was a big increase in economic activity. Many new jobs were created. Employment grew. And the 1980s, the result of the tax cuts of the 1980s, stimulated was the really beginning of the extraordinary 1990s.
It's very confusing for ordinary citizens when Nobel Prize winners disagree on the evidence, even two decades later.
It is very confusing, and the evidence is very difficult to interpret. These are complicated issues, and Paul is right. You don't have a controlled experiment, and people will interpret experience differently.
Well, and there we have it. We have a lot more callers who want to join this conversation. We have to take a short break first. We are blessed tonight with three Nobel Prize winners in economics debating the Bush tax cut plans. What do you think? Are you on the Bush tax cut bandwagon or lining up in opposition? Do record deficits scare you? Or are they the only way, as Milton Friedman says, to rein in government spending? Do you want a government that invests in the nation or gets out of the way? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by three Nobel Prize winners, Daniel McFadden, Milton Friedman, and Paul Samuelson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We will be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Nobel Challenge to the Bush tax plan and a Nobel defense. Yesterday, in the New York Times, 450 American economists, including 10 Nobel laureates, put their names to a protest against the Bush tax cut plan, saying they will hurt, they will not produce long-term growth, and they will create destruction. In the meantime, two of those Nobel laureates were Paul Samuelson, joining us tonight from Longboat, Florida, and Daniel McFadden, joining us tonight from Berkeley, California. In opposition, we have with us tonight Nobel Prize winner Milton Friedman, joining us from San Francisco, who says these are just the cuts we need. You can join the conversation tonight. Is President Bush's plan, as Daniel McFadden describes it, a weapon of mass destruction aimed at the middle class, or is it the key to long-term growth? And I guess I'd also ask, has the Bush administration been honest in this debate, or has it tried to sell long-term restructuring as short-term stimulus? If the Bush plan creates long-term growth, do we have to worry about Social Security, about schools, about income inequality? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Craig is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Craig. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks. Great.
Thanks for taking the call. It was curious, the president's proposed dividend tax cuts, why wouldn't it make more sense to offer deductions to the businesses rather than making them tax exempt to the people receiving the dividends.
Okay, fair enough. Daniel McFadden, can you take that on? Do you think the cut, would you be more likely to support the proposal if the cut were aimed elsewhere, aimed directly at corporations, not as dividend recipients?
I think it would make a good deal more economic sense if it was aimed at corporations and if, for example, dividends were exempt from the corporate income tax. That would be a pretty strong form way of doing it.
Mr. Greenspan recommended that in his testimony this week.
Yes, he did. Would that be enough, Paul Samuelson, to swing you over, or do we still have the fundamental dynamic that you describe and deplore?
No, that wouldn't be in itself enough. What is needed is to calculate the loss of revenue which this system has enjoyed, has needed to maintain what it's been doing, now maintained by other imperfect taxes. It's no secret that there isn't laying in wait a non-distortionary, perfect, Pareto neutral tax source. And public finance experts have studied this matter for a long time, and it's a very complicated balancing of pluses and minuses. And I'm afraid that people's social philosophy is the determiner of which way they come out in how they get an excess of one side of the pluses or one side of the minuses.
So we're talking to economists, but it's ultimately a political question. Milton Friedman, is this the ideal tax cut in your mind? Would you prefer another?
Yes. I would prefer to have the it handled by having dividend deductible the way interest payments are deductible at the corporate level. But that wouldn't change the impact of it. That would have exactly the same effect on the individuals who will be affected by this measure.
I think that's the first thing we've all agreed on tonight. Sean's calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Sean. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I was wondering if any of you guests could comment on how if hardworking men and women that are working full-time at minimum wage cannot exceed the U.S. poverty line, and if taxes are indeed our only way by which we can assure a safety net by redistributing some income. I wonder if they could speak to what the effect of the president's tax cut proposals may have on, one, the sedimentation of poverty within our country, and, two, on the workings of our democracy.
Sean, we've got it, but it's a bit of a tough telephone line. Let me reiterate just a little. Sean is asking about the impact of these tax cuts on income inequality and the likely long-term impact, if inequality is increased, on the health of the American democracy. Dan McFadden, let me come to you first. A, will these tax cuts increase income inequality? And B, what impact?
I think they would, and I think one of the reasons is that if you have large deficits and you have to reduce them, the programs that are easiest to reduce are probably the ones that are redistributional. A lot of the other things are entitlements or commitments like defense, which really cannot be reduced. So in that sense, I think, yes, it would have a large impact on people that are near the poverty level.
Milton Friedman, do you expect aggravated income inequality to come out of these tax cuts? And does it matter?
No, I do not. I think that the market reacts to them, that the market tends to look at income after tax in judging payments. So that I think this would not have a major effect on. And again, I go back to what Daniel McFadden said. There are many government spending that it would be desirable to eliminate. And it's not true that this would hit mostly, I think, at those that are good. I wish he would specify the good ones and keep them under lock and key.
But how do you do that once there's a general large deficit?
You don't. We all agree on that. You go through a political process. The political process is crude, fortunately or unfortunately. We're not going to be able to tell the government which particular items to eliminate. That comes from public pressure. And that's a good thing, that the public at large should determine what government does. Part of the problem we now have is that we have a political system under which we have too many special vested interests which have too much influence on what government does, like the agricultural lobby.
Paul Samuelson, let me turn to you first. On Milton Friedman has raised a number of things, but first on this core inequality issue. The statement that you've put your name to says these tax cuts will increase income inequality. I guess I'd ask, how serious an impact do you think that will have? And to our caller's question, what impact do you think that will have on the American democracy, American culture?
Well, I think it will have a predictably very large effect upon our mixed economy, which is an economy that does a certain amount of redistributing from the affluent, people like me, to the lower income groups. Let me give an example. The life table between the poor and the affluent back in the late 1920s, when I started to study economics.
That is the life expectancy.
It was very different. The rates charged for different kinds of insurance were very different. Today, because most of us don't pay for our medical care, there is a great narrowing of the divergence. That is certainly going to disappear under an eroding tax base. Now, there are certain philosophies which think, well, that's a good thing. Every tub should stand on its own bottom. I made it. Why can't they make it?
Meaning it's all right if lower income people just live less long.
Right. Look,
yes.
Let's not.
I'm speaking of this as a form of social Darwinism, and it's the reality that underlies these very technical economic questions. We have much more agreement on the technical economic cause and effects than we have on what the value judgment should be. But I think it's very clear that 2010, 2015, if the present trends continue, will be a completely different Gini coefficient of dispersion,
that
real
is
income.
Income distribution.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And that's be a very major thing. And this is quite aside from the inadequacies of the Bush program if, God forbid, we were going to go into a double-dip recession. There are a lot of easy things to do to go from the velvet recession we had to a recovery and to avoid a double-dip recession lasts at all. And I agree, by the way, with the Wall Street Journal reporter who said at the beginning, it's kind of unrealistic to think as with great probability a nation is about to go to war, there's going to be a great shortage of purchasing power. Hitler learned different in 1933, and he knew no economics. And Roosevelt learned different, and he started out knowing no economics.
Milton Friedman, we've just got a minute left. I want to put the big question to you.
Paul
Samuelson describes this not only as a choice about tax cuts, but a choice about the kind of nation we're going to be.
Of course it is, but I want to be clear about this. Let's stop this nonsense. Consider the medical case. In the medical case, what we have is redistribution from the poor to the rich, not the other way around.
Currently?
Yes, currently. If you take Medicare.
But if Medicare is unfunded or ultimately not able to go on, does that change the dynamic?
But take the situation with Medicare right now.
We've just got 50 seconds.
Yes. Well, Paul and I are both getting much more greater benefits from Medicare than we're relatively paying for. If there were no Medicare arrangement, we'd be spending a lot more of our own personal income on medical care. And that's true with a lot of these other proposals. There's very little redistribution from the rich to the poor. There's some from the rich to the middle class, and some from the poor to the middle class.
Well, we see a debate that's going to go right on, but it's been illuminating.
I think the vast majority of the elderly in this country that benefit from Social Security and Medicare are not in Milton's category of being rich enough, so it's distribution in the wrong direction.
And that's going to have to be the punctuation point tonight. Three Nobel Prize winners, Paul Samuelson, Daniel McFadden, Milton Friedman, thank you, each and every one, for joining us this evening. Thanks for the debate.
Okay.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, the grief worsens for the children of September 11th victims. This is On Point. For many children who lost parents in the September 11th terrorist attacks, the second year of grief is proving to be even more difficult than the first. The first year, you didn't know what was happening. You felt so empty, a 12-year-old boy said at a recent meeting of the grieving support group Comfort Zone Camp. It took me a while to realize that he wasn't coming home. Lynn Hughes is the founder of Comfort Zone Camp, which has been organizing weekend camps for the children of 9/11 victims for the past year and a half. In this radio diary, she says the kids she has worked with are struggling now more than ever.
The kids are now experiencing the pain almost more vividly, more freshly than they were a year ago, because a year ago everything was so numb. They were grieving in a fishbowl, and it was such an unprecedented tragedy, and they had such an onslaught of memorial service after memorial service after memorial service, sometimes not only for themselves but for their families, that, you know, the whole year was just a blur for them. And a lot of things they might have been typically doing in their everyday life, playing soccer or different activities, might have been put on hold. And now they might have just returned to going back to playing soccer, and they might miss, you know, dad being at the soccer game. In a lot of cases, dad was the soccer coach, and this is, you know, their first season really without dad being the soccer coach. So they're almost, you know, experiencing some of this stuff more freshly, or as if it had just happened. The one-year anniversary did not make it easier. It just made maybe some of the media fishbowl go away a little bit. But it just allowed the families to make the loss a little bit more private, a lot more private, a lot more personal. For some, it was the death anniversary. For some of it was even going into the first holidays, this past Christmas, when it really seemed like it's hitting them more. We started offering our programs as early as November of 2001, thinking, wow, you know, they just had this loss, they just had all these memorial services, and they're going into these holidays, and they're going to need some type of tools to help them cope with the very first holidays, and they just weren't ready. I mean, we put on camps, and we had very low attendance, and it was only these last two that we did in early February where we found the parents and the kids really, really receptive and almost eager to attend. They're just at a point where they recognize they're in pain, they're willing to do something public, labeling themselves as a 911 family, and to seek out those resources, whereas a year ago, many of them weren't even leaving their home or communities. Another thing is a lot of them this year, going into the second year of school, that they've started new schools. A lot of them might have started middle school or high school. And whereas last year, obviously everybody in their schools knew their story, that they have to make those decisions when they meet new friends or new teachers. Do they want them to know about their loss, or do they not want them to know? You know, on the one hand, it's very uncomfortable every time September 11th is mentioned that all heads turn and look at that child. They are often the only ones in their class or in their community. You know, they are the other kids' reference on September 11th. So, you know, a lot of them are really dealing with some new firsts without that loved one as a buffer. They're establishing that new type of normal existence, and the loved one isn't coming back. And I think they're just much more aware of that empty chair at the kitchen table, you know, at the school play, at the soccer game. So as before last year, where it might have just seemed like a one-time deal, or like, you know, maybe they were at work or maybe they're sick, now they're realizing that this is their new normal, and their new normal does not include their loved one being there.
Lynn Hughes is the founder of Comfort Zone Camp for children of 9/11 victims. For more information about the camp, visit onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Support for this